And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Friday as we get ready for the weekend with plenty to do over the next couple of hours. Coming up, Game 2 of the NBA Finals last night. Phoenix Suns take a 2-0 lead. What happened in Game 2 last night? Plus, why the Gamecocks football team... it's a lot like a baseball team this year. Also, who's most important for Clemson this football season? Should the Olympics actually get underway later on this month? And players are opting out of the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. We had a spelling bee last night. We got a lot to do. We'll catch up with the coach of the Charleston Battery as well later on this afternoon. And a whole lot more between now and 3 o'clock. You can join the conversation throughout the afternoon, 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. You can get to us on Twitter, at Morrow Middays, on Facebook, ESPN Charleston, via email, studio at kirkmanbroadcasting.com, or online by heading over to Charleston Sports Radio. There you can leave a comment for the show. You could find the show on demand, podcasted, by clicking on our show page. Or you can take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us right there online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3 on this Friday. And we got plenty to do over the next couple of hours. About an hour from now, we'll catch up with the head coach of the Charleston Battery to break down how their season's been going. They got a couple of games coming up here in the next few days. And we'll get to all that. But let me start with this. Game 2 of the NBA Finals was last night. And we spent a lot of time in preparation for Game 2 talking about adjustments. Game 1 of these series is always a feeling out process. And after you see what the other team can do, then it's up to you to try to react to that for the rest of the series. And then they have to adjust to your adjustments, and then you adjust to those adjustments, and it's just a series of adjustments. That's what coaching is, especially in a series against the same team. And the Milwaukee Bucks really struggled against the pick and roll of the Phoenix Suns in Game 1. They were switching on all screens. Phoenix was tearing them apart. Their big guys couldn't keep up with the guards. Phoenix was getting easy looks. They were getting to the foul line, scored 118 points, won Game 1. And as I said on the show yesterday, Game 2 would come down to two things. Number one being adjustments. What adjustments are the Bucks going to make to be able to handle that pick-and-roll type of offense from Phoenix to try to slow down the Suns? And the second part would be, what sort of Giannis are we going to get? Because he looked good, but obviously wasn't 100% in Game 1. He wasn't his normal self. And yet when he was on the floor, the Bucks still outscored the Suns in Game 1 of the NBA Finals. So if he's a little bit healthier, therefore a little bit better, so too would the Bucks. Right? The Bucks would be a better team. Maybe that could be the difference in Game 2. A healthier, better Giannis helps lead to a victory. And guess what? Both of those things happen, right? Giannis was fantastic last night. Played 40 minutes. Scored 42 points. He had almost half as many. He had almost half of the points of the team. He scored almost as many points as the rest of the team combined. Shot 15 of 22. Had a double-double. In fact, he had one of the better performances statistically of any player in the finals history in a loss. To go over 40 points, have over 10 rebounds, to shoot as he did. We haven't seen a lot of those performances that didn't lead to a victory. The problem was Giannis didn't get the help. And this is what we have been talking about for years with the Bucks. And many believe, Chris Middleton can be that guy. Then the Bucks went out and they added Drew Holiday this offseason, and many believed, okay, well, they got their big three. Except in the big moments, they don't come up very big. It's not a big three. And Giannis doesn't have enough help around him. Chris Middleton was 5 for 16 shooting last night. At 11 points. They're outscored by 15 when he played. Drew Holiday was 7-for-21. Right, they were outscored when he was on the floor. He ended up with 17 points. So Middleton and Drew Holiday shot a combined 12 of 37 last night. They were 2 of 9 from beyond the arc. They didn't do their part. Giannis did plenty, especially when you factor in that he's playing on a bum knee. Right, about a week removed, 10 days removed from the injury whenever it happened. And he's out there playing 40 minutes last night, going for 42 points. Played well, especially in the second half. He had, 20 points in one quarter? Set an NBA Finals record? Kept getting to the rim? He played really well. Just didn't get the help around him. And that's always been the issue with the Bucks. It's why Chris Middleton, I always say he's like a 3, right? Because at times he could be a 1. We've seen that in the NBA playoffs. He can play great. He looks like the best guy out there. At other times he plays like a 5, where it's like, I don't know if he should even be on the floor. That was the case last night. And so it averages out to a 3, and that's what he is. He's like a third best option on a team. He's not a star. He can't even be the Robin to a star. He's kind of that third guy. Drew Holiday is also kind of that third guy. You don't have that second option to chip in and help out Giannis. Giannis was good last night. His teammates weren't good enough. And the Bucks have to work seemingly so hard for their buckets, where the Phoenix Suns seem to be able to score a little bit easier. And the Bucks last night, we know Giannis can't shoot threes. So the idea is you try to surround him with three-pointers. It's what LeBron James has always done. And LeBron's obviously a better outside shooter than Giannis, but LeBron likes to drive the lane much like Giannis. So he wants a bunch of shooters on the arc so he can drive, kick it out. They could benefit from the open looks, knock down threes. Giannis, same idea. He needs some shooters around him. He drives to the rim. It'd be nice to kick it out and have somebody knock down a three because he can't do it. And the Bucks last night were 9-for-31 from beyond the arc. Meanwhile, the Phoenix Suns were 20 of 40. They made half of their three-pointers. And I was no math major, but that's a 33-point difference from beyond the arc. The Suns made 11 more threes than the Bucks. They outscored Milwaukee by 33 points from beyond the arc. They won by 10. And that's the difference in the game. The Bucks shot 29%. The Suns shot 50% from beyond the arc. Analytical folks were loving it last night, saying, this is what we've been saying for years. The Bucks are getting twos. The Suns are trading threes for them. Of course Phoenix is going to win. You get your twos. Let Giannis go right to the rim and lay it up. We'll go down to the other end and nail another three. Giannis was excellent. Giannis did his part. His teammates let him down once again, which has happened far too often for Milwaukee. It's why they haven't gotten to this point yet, and it's why now that they're here in the NBA Finals, they're down 2-0. Giannis isn't even 100%, and his supporting cast hasn't played well enough. They haven't played 100% either, and they don't have the injury excuse. The other aspect to last night's game going in, I told you, was the adjustments, right? Two parts. Two keys to last night's game. Is Giannis healthier and therefore playing better? No, he was. He did. Again, the Bucks outscored the Suns when Giannis was on the floor. In the 8 minutes that Giannis didn't play, the Bucks were outscored by 13. That was the difference in the game. He got no help. And the other part, like I said, were the adjustments from Milwaukee. Can Mike Budenholzer make the adjustments to slow down Phoenix? The first part to that question, yes. The second part, no. Did he make adjustments? Yes. Did it slow down Phoenix? No, not really. They scored 118 points again, the same total they had in Game 1. But Milwaukee did make adjustments. They were switching everything in Game 1 on the pick and roll on the screens. And they switched things up last night. They were trying to make things more difficult for Chris Paul and Devin Booker, and they decided to crowd their pick and rolls. But in doing so, it leaves more space for the shooters around the arc, especially the shooters that are off the ball. Right, Chris Paul or Devin Booker, when they don't have the basketball. Bridges had a couple of threes. Crowder had a few threes. Even off the bench, they got a few threes from Craig and Johnson. I mean, they shot 50%. Everyone was making threes. But it looked like it was working early on. The Suns were 1 of 9 on two-point tries in the first quarter, didn't attempt a free throw. Remember, Mike Budenholzer said, we got to keep these guys from getting to the free throw line. And in the first quarter, the Suns looked a little bit slow. Right? They came out a little flat, weren't making shots inside the arc that they were getting in Game 1, weren't getting to the free throw line like they did in Game 1. Took half as many foul shots last night as Game 1 and looked like, ooh, this could be working. Problem is, it left shooters open, and shooters took advantage. And by halftime, the Suns had an assist on over two-thirds of their baskets. They already had as many three-pointers in Game 2 at halftime than they did all of Game 1. And by the end of the game, they set a franchise record for most three-pointers in a playoff game and had the second-most threes in an NBA Finals game. The Golden State Warriors were Golden State Warriors, I believe, hold the record. And they had quite a few great shooters. Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, even Kevin Durant. Better outside shooters than, say, Chris Paul, DeAndre Booker, and Crowder. Right? I should say Devin Booker. I was thinking of who? DeAndre Baker? I don't know. Who's DeAndre Booker? Devin Booker. And the Suns still, regardless, able to make the second most threes in an NBA Finals game. And I was thinking back to, you see it all the time in crime movies. Movies about, like, serial killers. Movies about criminals that the police are trying to catch. It happens in all the films. But I was thinking about Heat. In the movie Heat that came out 25 years ago, where Al Pacino, he's the cop, and his crew, they're trying to find and catch Robert De Niro, who's the criminal in this movie. And there's a great scene in the movie where they think they have De Niro. Right? De Niro's meeting with his associates, and he's talking about something. He's talking about escape routes, and they're meeting, and it's like the classic. This used to be a thing in all the movies. I don't know if it's still the case. Maybe it's reality as well. Whenever the bad guys get together, they always do it like on the docks, right? And you always have those big like trailers and the cranes and everything, and you're by the water, and it's like a real sketchy scene. All the movies always have the big showdown happen there, like a big shootout. People are hiding behind those trailers at the dock. Someone gets knocked into the water. Right, the fatal shot leads to the bad guy falling in the water. In all the classic 90s crime movies, the bad things are always happening right at like the dock. Somewhere by the water where people are unloading things and there's cranes and big trucks and trailers and all that sort of stuff. So De Niro is meeting there with his guys, and he's talking about their plans. And Pacino and his cops are staking out, and they're listening in. They're on top of one of like the water towers, and they have their little radars that they can listen into their conversation. And so De Niro and all his guys get in their cars and they drive off. And Pacino and the cops then walk out. Right? They think the coast is clear. They come out and they think, okay, what are they doing? Right? They're trying to figure out De Niro's plan and what exactly he's doing. At one point, Pacino even says, like, are they stealing hubcaps? They're trying to figure out, what exactly are they doing? Are they moving product? What's that product? What are they stealing? What are they selling? We know they're doing something wrong. We just don't know what it is. And they're looking around and they're wondering and they're talking and they're asking each other and they're throwing out ideas. Well, maybe they're doing this. Maybe they're doing that. Maybe they're doing this. And Pacino finally realizes, it dawns on him, wait a minute. Right? This was all a setup. They weren't actually meeting here about actual business. They were meeting here because they knew we were going to come out here. And that's what he says. You know what they're looking at? Because that's what they're saying throughout the scene. What are we looking at here? Right? Are they stealing hubcaps? Are they doing this, doing that? What are we looking at? And Pacino at the end says, you know what they're looking at? They're looking at us. And then the cameras zoom out and you see De Niro far away looking through a lens taking photos of them. And De Niro just set him up so he could see, okay, who's on my tail? Who do I have to worry about? Who's after me? Who are these cops that are investigating me? And as Pacino says at the end of the scene, we've been made. And he starts yelling, you know, calling De Niro a mother effer. Starts screaming out, a classic Pacino in the last 25 years, just always yelling. And he was yelling out to De Niro because he knew he was watching him. And he knew he got fooled. And I go on that tangent and give you the details of that scene because that's like what happened last night. What always happens in these crime movies, the criminal doesn't get caught because he's staying a step ahead of the police coming after him. That was the case for De Niro in Heat. He knew Pacino was on his tail. They were gonna figure out what they were up to. They were going to try to catch him. He set up a trap just so he could see, okay, I know someone's coming after me. I know it's the cops, but I don't know who. Who's investigating me? And he set him up, and Pacino realized it. And that was the case last night. The Suns knew, okay, we killed them with the pick and roll. We know the Bucks are going to make adjustments. It's not going to be as easy as it was in Game 1. We're not going to be able to get to the rim. We're not going to get to the free throw line as often. Chris Paul isn't going to get as many open looks from the mid-range. What can we do to counteract their adjustments? And sure enough, the Bucks came out, and almost like they fell right into their trap like Pacino in Heat, right? Okay, here's what we're going to do. All right, we're going to hedge on the screens. We're going to double-team the ball handler. We're going to keep him from getting in the lane. And so they're dishing it off and knocking down threes instead. They said, all right, they want to take away the shots in the lane. They want to pay so much attention to the ball screens, right? We'll use that as almost like a decoy. Kick it out, knock down threes. They made 50% of their threes last night. They made 23 pointers. It's why they won the game. Right? That's De Niro flipping the table, flipping the script, turning the tables on Pacino, where originally Pacino and the cops were watching them through the cameras, taking photos. And then by the end of the scene, it's De Niro taking photos of Pacino, which is more valuable. Right, the Suns were the ones knocking down the threes, more valuable last night. Say, okay, fine. Do what you want on the screens. Take away our ability to get to the free throw line. We'll trade in those one-point shot attempts for three-point shot attempts. Knock down all these threes. And we see it all the time in movies, right? How do these criminals continue to get away in all these films? They're staying one step ahead of those pursuing them. How were the Suns able to win Game 2? They continue to remain one step ahead of the Milwaukee Bucks. In Game 1, the Bucks had no answer for the pick and roll. Game 2, they came back with that answer, and the Suns had an even better answer for their response. And said, fine, you do that, we'll do this. And this happened to be making half of their three-pointers, setting a record in the process and winning by double digits again last night. And that's the key, right? It's the chess match. When you get to an NBA Finals, when you get to an NBA playoff series, coach versus coach, star versus star, you have to stay one step ahead. You know they're going to come with an adjustment. You got to take their swing and come back with one of your own, right? Take their punch and land an even harder one. And that's what Phoenix did last night with those threes. Now, for Milwaukee moving forward, you can continue to try to be positive, right? You can say, well, you know, in Game 1, they made 25 foul shots. That's not going to happen again. And we were on the road, and we didn't play all that great. Giannis was injured, right? And we were still hanging in there. And then Game 2, the Bucks, you know, that came down to the final minutes, and you could say, well, there's no way the Suns are going to make 23-pointers in a game again. And we still had a chance to beat them in the fourth quarter on the road. We'll be okay. Right, Giannis is getting healthier. You'll also hope, if you're the Bucks, that, oh, Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday will never shoot it that poor again in this series. Right, if you're looking at the glass half full on the Milwaukee side, you could say, oh, these are things that can't continue to be repeated. We'll be fine, especially once we get home. And maybe that's the case. But so far, Phoenix has been able to stay one step ahead of the Bucks, and we'll see what we have for Game 3 on Sunday. Now the Bucks, it's on them again to make another adjustment. And then Phoenix will have to try to stay one step ahead. And if Monty Williams can't, then the Bucks will get a win. But if the Suns can come back and take the blow thrown by Milwaukee again on Sunday and respond with an even sharper right hook, they'll move up 3-0. With that said, I would hammer the Milwaukee Bucks on Sunday. I believe they're favored from the odds I've seen. I believe they're a pretty good money line favorite and favored by 3.5. But history tells us that that team heading home in any series, down 2-0, they win outright Game 3 something like 75% of the time. The Bucks will be desperate. They'll be home. That place will be crazy. Giannis will be a little healthier. We have 2 days off until the next game. He played really well last night. Middleton and Drew Holiday will shoot better at home than they did last night in Phoenix because that's what role players do. They play better in front of their home crowd. The Bucks will win Game 3. They'll try to make this some sort of a series. But through the first two games, you can see why the Suns are up 2-0. They have been the better team. They have been one step ahead of Milwaukee. They've been able to handle the adjustments with better ones of their own. And teams that take a 2-0 lead in the NBA Finals are 31-4 in the series. Only four times has a team erased an 0-2 deficit in the NBA Finals. We'll see if the Bucks can do that. Now, Giannis was speaking after the game to the media about being out there. Look, he's clearly not 100%, but he played great last night. And he said, hey, this is what I have to do. I have to be out there. We'll see if he's even healthier and better come Sunday, but he's going to need more help from the supporting cast. He'll need more out of Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday if the Bucks want to make this a series. Phoenix won Game 2 by staying one step ahead, like all of the criminals in these movies, like De Niro and Heat. He fooled Pacino, right? He got him. Pacino thought they were closing in, oh, we got him now, and they fell right into the trap. And De Niro got exactly what he wanted, and that was last night. The Bucks were thinking, we got them now. 1-for-9 in the first quarter on twos, didn't get to the free throw line. The Bucks were leading after the first quarter. They thought, we got them now. We figured out this whole pick and roll thing. And it turned out the Suns actually had them right where they wanted them. They said, all right, fine, keep doing that. We'll start taking threes. And Phoenix outscored the Bucks by double in the second quarter. Took the lead by half, made the most threes they ever have for a franchise in a playoff game, and went on to take a 2-0 lead in the series. Coming up, baseball players seem like they do not want to participate in next week's All-Star Game. How big of an issue is this? We'll get to that coming up. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Coming up, baseball players don't want to participate in the All-Star game. Is there more to it? And is it a concern for Major League Baseball? Get to that here in the Moore Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. I heard the story on Greeny, I think it was last week. Actually, Mike Greenberg and his wife are in Charleston right now. So, hello, Greeny. Hope you're having a great vacation here in the Lowcountry. They're here this week. But I heard the story last week on Greeny, which you can hear on this same station before we come on the air, where his statistician, Hembo, who you'll hear on that show or you can see on ESPN's Get Up, thought that this was by Alien Ant Farm and Michael Jackson was the one doing the cover. Smooth Criminal. Now, it is a good version by Alien Ant Farm that came out about 20 years ago. Growing up, my brothers and I, you know, if you're of a certain age, you may have made a mixtape back in the day, especially for, you know, a girl that had your eye. Back in high school, you'd make a mix or vice versa, whatever the scenario may be. But back when I was growing up with my brothers, we would make like a mixtape for ourselves, not for any sort of girl or anything. But we made our own mixtape of music videos. Just like you would get up and run to the tape deck and record that song on the radio station that you wanted to have. We were so into VH1 and MTV back when they actually played music videos. And so we just had a VHS of just music video after music videos that we liked or songs that we liked, the music videos. And we would actually go back and like watch it every once in a while. You'd put it on and be like, you know, the soundtrack in the background, or you'd watch the music videos. Obviously, if you're of a certain age, remember how big music videos used to be. It was a big deal. And that was a good one. Alien Ant Farm, we had that on the mixtape. And it was like at a house party, I remember, and they were playing that song and people were obviously going crazy. There was like a mosh pit. And then the lead singer he jumped on a car and did a Michael Jackson impression with like the crotch grab and the car, the windows blew out. I remember that music video. I haven't seen it in years, but it's on the mixtape somewhere. I don't know where that mixtape is, but we had all our favorite music videos from the time. You know, like Red Hot Chili Peppers' Californication, when it was like a video game. That was very cool back then. Late 90s, they made a music video that looked like a video game. Are you kidding? That was on the mixtape. Good stuff. But I heard that story from Hembo on Greeny last week, where he thought, when he heard that song, he thought, why is Michael Jackson covering Alien Ant Farm? And there's so much wrong with that question or belief. Hey, the Major League Baseball All-Star Game's coming up after the weekend. We get the Home Run Derby on Monday, All-Star Game on Tuesday, and then baseball's actually getting back to things a little bit sooner this year. A lot of times, the games don't start up again until Friday. This year, teams are actually playing on Thursday. So the All-Star break, you get Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday next week. Wednesday, nothing going on. That's just the day off. Monday, Home Run Derby. Tuesday is the All-Star Game. Now, Jacob DeGrom originally announced that he wasn't going to participate in the All-Star Game. And DeGrom, of course, is the best pitcher in baseball. So it's a bit of a shame you don't get to see him on the big stage. But I get it from a pitcher's standpoint, because this is extra innings. It's also potentially an off day, right, like in between starts for you. You know, like Jacob DeGrom, I believe, is supposed to pitch this weekend. And that's the reason why. It's not just like, I don't want to be there. His reasoning is, well, I don't want to pitch in the game because it's going to be on short rest, even if it's just an inning. Even if it's just a throw day for him anyways, he's going to throw a little bit on the side. Why not do it in an All-Star game? Right, he's having a great season. He's had health issues this year. He's had four separate issues this year in which he's either missed time or had to come out of a game. Right, so you can understand why DeGrom wouldn't want to participate. He's saying, look, you know, short rest. We're a first place team. I don't want to jeopardize. I've already had arm issues this year. I don't want to jeopardize my season by pitching an inning in an All-Star game. It's a great honor, but it's also, you know, in the grand scheme of things, kind of meaningless. You don't look back and think like, well, he never won a World Series, but he pitched really well in All-Star games. So I get it from DeGrom's standpoint. The common comparison is Pedro Martinez. When Pedro pitched in the 99 All-Star game, and that's when he had like the immaculate inning. He struck out the side. It was at Fenway Park. Of course, Pedro was starting. He was the best pitcher in the game at the time. And then after that, his first start of the second half, he got bombed. Pitched well the rest of the way. But then come 2002, when Pedro was added to the All-Star game, he said, no, I don't want to pitch this year. Right, because after the 99, it kind of threw him out of whack pitching in the All-Star game. It's a little awkward for pitchers. Pitchers are on a schedule. Now you throw this exhibition game in the middle of that schedule. For hitters, hitters don't have the same excuse. Where hitters have the excuse, it's with the Home Run Derby. You want to tell me you don't want to participate in the Home Run Derby? I get it. We've seen guys fall apart in the second half of seasons after Home Run Derbies. The data is there. Not for everybody, but for some guys that participate in the Derby, either it tires you out or it changes your swing, right? It gets you out of whack, screws up your mechanics because you're trying to hit home runs, which a lot of guys now are doing. Right? That's their normal swing anyways. Every time they step to the plate, they're trying to hit home runs. But, you know, at least back in the day when we had more well-rounded hitters that weren't used to uppercut swings or launch angle, they were just trying to hit the ball, and then you go to the home run derby, you're changing your swing to try to hit home runs, throws you out of whack. Screws up your swing. So I get why hitters wouldn't want to participate in the home run derby. But to me, hitters that don't want to participate in the All-Star game is kind of weak. Right? You don't really have an excuse. You're only going to play a couple of innings. You'll get an at-bat or two. We know baseball isn't, the game itself isn't the most tiring. Right? Like football, you tell me you have to play a random football game during your season. It's like, well, football is grueling enough. You want me to play an exhibition game? Right? These guys wake up, they feel like they're in a car crash every Monday. And if you were to ask them mid-season, like, hey, now you're going to play in this exhibition game full speed, it's like, I don't know about that. But baseball, I mean, come on, really. You're like the first baseman, right? You do some standing around, you get a couple of at-bats, you move a little bit in the field, you'll play about three or four innings. Is it really that draining? You were off the day before, you'll be off the day after if you weren't in the home run derby, right? And then you go on with your season. You're used to playing every day. You're used to playing 162 games. For a hitter, it could help with your timing to get some swings in instead of taking 3 days off from live pitching. And yet, after DeGrom's announcement, we've gotten more announcements from the Houston Astros, with Carlos Correa and Jose Altuve, both of the Astros, saying that they won't participate in this year's All-Star game, that they're taking the season, or I should say the All-Star game, off. And it's not because of health concerns like maybe DeGrom. It's not because it could throw them off of their routine or schedule, but instead completely other reasons as well. Now, we have the audio and the excuses here when they spoke with the media the last couple of days. Carlos Correa and Jose Altuve. And they were talking, they were giving their reasons for why they don't want to play, or in fact won't play. They've made their decision. They've told the media why they won't be participating in the All-Star game. Carlos Correa shared his reasoning with the media yesterday for why he is opting out of the All-Star game next week.
With the baseball season, it's pretty much like wake up, eat breakfast, go to the field, get back, go to sleep, and do it all over again. So, I haven't even had that much time to, like, read books to the belly and sing to the belly and all that. You know, I talk every day, but I wanna be able to spend more time with her and the baby. And also, you know, with COVID, everything takes 4 months to be delivered, so we gotta start planning and buying everything for the nursery and all this stuff that we need for the baby, so we're also going to do that during the break.
Carlos Correa, who says he won't be there because his wife or girlfriend is pregnant, with their first child, by the way, and that's a big moment. The kid, they're still a few months away, but, you know, he wants to spend a few days with the mother of his child to get ready for the kid's arrival. And family is always one of those that you can't question, like, the excuse. If you ever say, I got something going on with the family, right? No one's going to say, like, what's going on? Prove it. They always do that. That's an old bit, like, in the movies, and I'm sure it was true as well. But whenever people would try to get, like, free flights, right? Or they try to cancel their flight, and they say, there's a death in the family, right? We have to go home, or I have to fly out there for a funeral. And they would say, yeah, present the death certificate. In fact, that was like in Ferris Bueller's Day Off when they called to get whatever her name was. What was Ferris's girlfriend's name? They had to get her out of school, and they said that her grandmother passed away, and the principal thought it was Ferris. So he said, that's fine. Present the dead body, and we'll release her today. My whole point being, those are comedy movies. Usually when somebody says there's something going on with the family, you don't question them. You don't say, like, well, prove what's going on, right? Show me the medical report that somebody is going through a health issue. In this case, it's a pregnancy. But that's one of the classic excuses you can always use. Mental health, which I'm very sympathetic towards. I understand the mental health struggles that many deal with and feel for those that deal with such a thing. But mental health has become another one that you can never question, right? Like Aaron Rodgers the other day said that as well, that this offseason, the whole thing staying away from the Packers, he's working on his mental health. Could be true, may not be, but I do know, regardless, when somebody says that, right, no one's going to question him. Oh, mental health, yep, okay, that's good, right? You got to get that taken care of. No one's going to say, like, I don't know if I believe you. So there's certain things that you can always throw out there, no one's going to question you. For Carlos Correa, the reason why he won't participate next week, as he said, was because of his family getting ready for the birth of a child. Jose Altuve had a more baseball-related reason for why he won't be participating. Here's Correa's teammate on the Astros, Jose Altuve, telling the media yesterday why he won't be playing next week.
I really want to thank everybody that vote for me, that believe in me, and I really need this 4 days. I'm putting my team first because I really think we have a chance to win this year.
So Altuve is doing it because the Astros are in first place. He thinks they have a chance to win this year. He thinks it would be best for the team if he does not participate in the All-Star game, instead having a few days off. Now, I think there's more to it here. Forgive me for being skeptical, but I think when it comes to these Astro players opting out, I think it's because of the whole cheating scandal from a couple of years ago. Right? I think it's because the Astros still haven't had to face the music. It happened last year, or at least was exposed prior to last year. They had a real tough time in spring training. And then the regular season brought no fans because of the pandemic. Then this year came around, and they're dealing with it a little bit from the fans. We didn't have full stadiums at first. Now when they go on the road, fans are still giving the Astros a hard time, to the point that we've heard their manager, Dusty Baker, talking about how the fans should be nicer. We did our time, yada, yada. Dusty Baker whining about it, complaining, trying to protect his guys for how they've been treated. But there's something different about being amongst your own peers, right? Or being at that All-Star game with those fans. Like, we've heard from many baseball players on other teams that have been very vocal in their disappointment or frustration or anger towards the Astros for what they did banging on trash cans. Now, if you're Altuve and Correa, you'd be walking into that locker room with guys, other guys that are unhappy with you. This isn't you don't have the safety of your own locker room. When you walk into your own locker room at Houston, no one's going to give you a hard time because half those guys were cheating anyways, and the new players came to Houston for a reason. They signed there anyways, and they're your teammates, so they probably won't give you a hard time in the locker room every day. You go into another team's locker room and see somebody for the first time in person, face-to-face, since this has happened, and there's a lot of upset people in the league. They may say something. You may even hear the snide remark, people under their breath, whatever it may be, treating you poorly for the couple of days in Denver in the locker room. And then once you get out on that field, the happy experience of an All-Star game will probably be taken away because of the reaction those guys would get from the fans. I think this is the Astros players just simply hiding from the potential reaction they could get from their peers and the fans. You know, it's a lot like earlier I was talking about Heat. I was talking about crime movies. Another one that I talk about a lot is Goodfellas. It's my favorite film of all time. But in Goodfellas, it's based on Henry Hill, and Henry Hill, by the end of the movie, you know, turns into a rat. He turns into a snitch. When he gets caught, he gets arrested for the drugs he was selling, and he throws everyone else under the bus to lessen his punishment. Eventually, he enters the witness protection program. But Henry Hill, when he first goes to jail for drugs, he says that to his wife, Karen, like, you got to get me out of here, right? I'm safer on the streets than I am here in jail. And then once he got out on the streets and he was talking with the government and the police department and everything, and he was going to testify, he said, they're talking about sending him to Arizona in the witness protection program because he knew if I stay around here, I'm in big trouble. Because in the mafia or the mob or just in crime circles in general, like if you snitch on your constituents, they're going to come after you. You'd rather be somewhere else than these guys would rather be elsewhere than even go into jail because they know once they walk in there, right, I'm in there with all of other criminals, and they look down on this idea that me, a criminal, right, ratted on my partners. And it's similar to the baseball players. It'd be like Henry Hill walking into jail when Altuve and Correa walk into that locker room. It's like, oh boy, we're walking into this fraternity of players that we have, broken the trust, we betrayed, that we cheated a couple of years ago, that are very upset with us, and we don't want to deal with it. Much like for you, you may not care what your friends think, but if word got back to your parents and your parents are very upset with something you did, right, that's the one that cuts you deep. Like, it's okay if your friends find out you did something regrettable, but you don't want to go home and have your parents find out. There's always, every person has that, eventually you'll get to that point on the ladder, on the scale, that you don't want to see their reaction or you don't want them to know of something that occurred. Same idea, like at school, you may, whatever, your buddies, it's not a big deal if they know you're struggling in school. You go home, you don't want your parents to find out, have to walk into the house and deal with that reaction. Correa and Altuve don't want to walk into that locker room, have to deal with some sort of reaction, walk out onto the field and have to deal with some sort of reaction there either. And so it's just easier to avoid it. I think it's been very soft the way that the Astros have handled this whole thing from day one. And by the way, Altuve and Correa were not voted in by the fans. So the fans don't want them there. So the fans, I'm sure, would give them an unwelcome hand, right? An unwelcome reception in Colorado. It's not like they voted them there. It's not like they want them there. And the one Astro player that is playing, Michael Brantley, just came to the team in the last 2 years. So he's not really considered one of the cheaters. And he's on the Astros. He's going to the All-Star game, and he's actually playing. Why? Because he doesn't have to worry about that reaction. The Astros are in first place. If Altuve's saying, yeah, I'm going to sit out because it's best for the team, well, how come Michael Brantley is going to play? because he knows, I don't have to go face that music. I didn't do that. I wasn't here. Right, these other guys, they're the ones that cheated. They're going to have to worry about that. I walk into that locker room. Yeah, people may give me a hard time for being their teammate. Right, but I'm not a cheater. Their issue isn't with me. It's with those guys. And I think that's why Altuve and Correa are staying away. They can say whatever they want. But I think the real reason is they just don't want to face the music once again. They really haven't had to since this whole scandal broke in baseball to begin with.
Could there be another reason?
What's that?
That could be the whole controversy about moving the All-Star game from Atlanta to Denver earlier this year.
I don't think those players care. I don't think Altuve or Correa care one bit where the game's being played.
Oh, but then again, too, they might be saying, you know, this year's game has been tainted. Maybe I just don't want anything to do with it.
I mean, there may be somebody who feels that way. We'll see if anyone else opts out in the next couple of days or lists that as a reason. I don't think Correa or Altuve, I don't even think that's on their radar.
Do you think if they do opt out, that they're going to actually say that or they're going to come up with some other reason? Try to avoid, you know, the political controversy.
Yeah, I mean, somebody may not want to admit to it if that was the reason. I think that has passed us by at this point. I don't think the baseball players ever really cared. I don't think that was ever on the radar. They'll show up wherever the game is. They'll play wherever. I don't think they really care. Maybe Braves players would be unhappy. But who Acuna is going? I don't even know who's going to the All-Star game. I haven't looked at the roster. I don't care about the All-Star game as much as I once did as a kid. I imagine they'll be there. I don't really think they care. I don't think baseball players care that much. They just want to go out there and play. They don't really care where they're playing or the off-the-field politics of it all. So, All-Star Games next week. We'll see if any other players opt out. And if it's just DeGrom, I get that. Pitcher, health issues. Pitchers do it all the time. And if the only position players are Altuve and Correa, to me, it's a little suspicious. Guys could take off from the All-Star Game every year. They could find reasons every year to not be there. Most of them will, except for Altuve and Correa. It's like when you get caught, right? You get arrested, you get caught for, don't put me in prison, just kill me, the criminals will say in some movies. In fact, I just watched a show the other night that the guy, instead of getting arrested, he said that. Right, just kill me now. I don't want to go to jail, because if I go into jail, I know what's waiting for me. Just put me out of my misery now. And that's Altuve and Correa. And I'm not going there. I'm not walking into that locker room. I'm going home. I'm avoiding that situation. I'm avoiding that misery for a couple of days. It's supposed to be a joyous occasion at the All-Star game. Everyone's going to treat me terribly because of what I did a few years ago. They've never admitted to it. They've never really apologized to it. They've always hidden from it. Dusty Baker was complaining again about the reaction. He was complaining this week about how they didn't get voted in. Oh, the fans have treated our team so poor. They didn't vote our guys in the All-Star game. Gee, I wonder why. Maybe if you showed some sort of, if you showed some sort of remorse along the way. If you took the punches that you deserve, maybe then we feel a little bit better about you. Anyways, All-Star break coming up next weekend. We'll be joined by a former big leaguer Monday through Thursday. We'll see if we can work on Friday next week. Get one for every day. But next week, we'll have former big leaguers join us throughout the week talking about the All-Star break, the season, and everything else going on in baseball. Hey, speaking of baseball, when we come back, the Gamecocks football team is a lot like a baseball team this year. And I'll explain why when we come back. It's the Mara Midday Show, right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Yo, what up?
What's the word, big fella? Everything's good on this end.
Hey, Luke, how's it going? Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, Luke. Hey, man. Pleasure to be on your show.
Great show. You did a good job.
Hey, you're turning into rapidly my favorite person I've interviewed with, and I've done like 50 of these in the last week.
You've done your homework. I like it. I absolutely like it. I love that.
Another great thought.
You've done your homework, haven't you? Good job.
You're always getting these big stars and important people on. That's great to hear. And we like to hear the interviews.
You know, it's uncanny how you do this, Luke. And I don't know how you do, because I do this gauntlet of radio on Thursdays where I do all these different cities. Many of them need their hosts to have me give them some talking points. You hit all my talking points every week. It's uncanny how good you are.
Always great talking football with you, Luke. Appreciate you guys being right.
Very impressive.
Shout out to all the people in Dolphin that support the show.
Tell your friends. Tell your friends.
Da 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 da. Da 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 da. Go ahead, boy. That's why you bring it on.
Is this a sports show or a dancing show?
I don't know. Sometimes I don't know what we're doing around here.
Lunch with Luke for 3 hours, anything goes.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Just do.
Coming up, why the Gamecocks football team is actually like a baseball team. It's the Moore Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Let's talk about the All-Star Game last segment. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand, ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. You can also find the show on demand online at charlestonsportsradio.com or through our free app. Just search ESPN Charleston in the App Store. And you can find the podcast available there. But speaking of baseball, it got me thinking, you know, the Gamecocks this year are kind of like a baseball team. Because there's this thought process in baseball, an old cliche in the game of baseball, that every team is going to lose 60 games, every team is going to win 60 games, and then your season is going to come down to the other 42. Right? Not often do we get teams that lose over 100 games. Not often do we get teams that win over 102 games. So usually you'll have 60 wins, you'll have 60 losses. There are always exceptions along the way. And then your season will be determined by the other 42 games of your season. And if you win three quarters of those, right, you're winning a division. You're winning over 90 games, you'll be in first place. You win half of those, you're a 500 team. Makes sense. That's what you are. You played 500 ball throughout the year. So I was thinking about this because as I look at the Gamecocks schedule this year, it's pretty similar. They have four games that they should certainly win. They have four games that I think they should lose, and then their season will be decided by how the other four games go. And if you split those, well, it will be a good season. It'll be a 500 year, but that'll be good for the Gamecocks. If you somehow win all four, that's a really good year. Just like in baseball, if you win of those other 42 games, you win, I don't know, say 35 of them. Right? That's a really good year. Now you're pushing 100 victories. It's the same idea for South Carolina. And I was looking at ESPN's FPI. And ESPN's FPI, they have the Gamecocks as the 68th best team this year. They put their projected win-loss record at 4.5 victories. And so somewhere around there. Take the over if you wish. Somewhere around 4 to 5 wins. They also give them a 0% chance of winning out, 0% chance of winning the SEC, and rank the Gamecocks as having the 16th toughest schedule. But as you look through these games, they give South Carolina... They make South Carolina the favorite. That'd be the proper way to say it. They make South Carolina the favorite in four of their games. They give them a 99% chance to beat Eastern Illinois, an 82% chance to beat Vanderbilt, a 68% chance to win at East Carolina, and a 61% chance to beat Troy. And those are the four games that I would give as the wins. Those are four wins South Carolina should and really needs to have. They'll be favored in all of those games. They're the better program than all of those teams. You have to win those games, even in year one of Shane Beamer. But then ESPN's FPI gives South Carolina less than a 7% chance in three of their games. That would be at Georgia, at Texas A&M, and Clemson at the end of the year. They have less than a 7% chance to win any of those three. The fourth game I would throw in would be next on the list, Florida, which ESPN's FPI gives the Gamecocks a 22% chance of winning at home against Florida in the second half of the year. It's doable. I don't think it will be done, so I give 4 wins, 4 losses. And I've said this on the show before, but this year's Gamecock season will then come down to those other four games. We can call them swing games. And that includes Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, and even Auburn I would throw in there. I would choose Auburn over Florida as the swing game. Auburn is at home towards the end of the year. Florida is also at home a couple of weeks earlier. I think Auburn's the easier matchup than Florida. I don't know if either one is easy, but I think they stand a better chance to beat Auburn at home than they do Florida. But maybe you could say you could swap out one or the other, right? Maybe one of those two. But those are the four games that could decide their season. Kentucky at home, at Tennessee, at Missouri, and then I'll say home against Auburn. And if you split those games, you're going to a bowl game, and that would be a successful year. If you find a way to somehow win 3 out of 4, you're finishing the season 7-5. That'd be a good year. And if you somehow win all four of those swing games and finish with 8 wins in year one of Shane Beamer, that would be a great year. Don't count on that. Don't hold your breath waiting out those 8 victories, but that's the best case scenario. 4 losses are already written into the schedule. 4 wins are written in. What are you going to do with those other 4 games? That will determine the season. ESPN's FPI gives the Gamecocks a 43% chance of winning against Kentucky. So close to a coin flip. A 31% chance to win at Tennessee. I was surprised that was as low as it was. A 30% chance to win at Missouri. I do think that will be a tougher game than many may believe. And a 25% chance to beat Auburn at home, which isn't necessarily a game you should win. I think it's a game you could win. New coach at Auburn. Never been the biggest fan of their quarterback. Late in the season, they're getting ready for Alabama the next week. I know South Carolina will be getting ready for Clemson, but, you know, a little bit of a look ahead. Maybe a little bit of a trap game for Auburn at the end of the year, coming to Columbia. I don't think it's a game that you should win, but could. Maybe I'd put it a little higher than 25%, but that's what it'll come down to, just like a baseball team. Every year, you know, just about every baseball team's going to win 60 games, lose 60 games. And whatever those teams do in their other 42 will decide the season, will decide the playoffs. Who can do the best job in those other 42 games? Because every baseball schedule, there's always exceptions, right? The Dodgers may win over 100 games. Red Sox a couple years ago won 108 games. The Yankees back in the day won over 110. The Mariners, right? There's always an exception every couple of years. But normally, you know, in a baseball season, you got 60 losses written into a schedule, 60 wins written into a schedule. What are you going to do with the rest of the games? Same idea here with South Carolina. Four wins written in, four losses written in. Your season will come down to those four swing games. You split them, you go to a bowl game, and I think that's a success in year one of Shane Beamer. We'll get to Clemson coming up a little bit later on this afternoon, looking at their FPI odds, as well as the most important person to Clemson's season this year. We'll do that a little bit later this afternoon. But you can always join the conversation, 843-721-9500, to give us a call before we go at the top of the hour. Let's go to the phones because Super Dave is with us. Dave, what's going on? How are you?
I'm counting the days to August 28th. I think that's 50 days away.
50 days, you tell us?
Yeah.
I don't know if that math is correct. We may have to double-check you. But we're getting there. We're getting close.
Well, let's say.
Oh, I guess you are right. 50 days, it says. Yeah. Okay.
22 days left, and then you get to 28th. So 2 to 10, 3, 2 to 5, 50.
Yeah.
What I count.
You nailed it. I take it back. You're good. 50 days till football. How about that?
Yeah. That'd be the small schools, but hell, football's football, right?
Yeah.
Hear the whistle blow again. That'd be great.
Ah, yes. Nothing better.
Yes, sir. So I look forward to UCLA and Hawaii. I think that will be a pretty good game.
Yes, you're very excited. Who are you rooting for? You know, you're waiting 66 days, going back to the original countdown. You've been waiting
I'm
for this game.
I'm still there. Same thing.
So you got to be. You're going to be so stoked for this game. Who are you going to become a fan of one of these teams? You're waiting for this game so much. Who are you rooting
UCLA,
for?
UCLA, of course.
Oh, UCLA.
Yeah, they're not a bad team.
You're going to become a UCLA fan now.
Yeah.
You think UCLA wins that game?
I'm not a bandwagon jumper now, but I'm still a Gamecock fan, but I still like UCLA. I like them, their odds of beating Hawaii.
Okay.
You know, they're not very good, but it's a game, you know?
That's why they play.
Are they playing at Hawaii, or are they playing at their deal?
No, it's in California.
Okay. So they should win that game easy, you know?
Ooh, an easy win for UCLA.
Yeah, because they're a home game.
Okay.
You know.
All right. Well, we look forward to that in 50 days. I don't know what's going on over there at Super Dave. Hopefully all is well. Yeah, 7 weeks from yesterday, actually, right? Because isn't there Thursday football that first week, or does it begin on the Saturday? Maybe it does begin on that Saturday, August 28th. That's what Super Dave's been saying. Who am I to question him?
If I had it my way, it would start on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
With South Carolina and Clemson playing
That's
each other.
Right.
And, of course, Bobby is, you know, mashing his teeth together now, you know, would be mentioning this idea.
It's not a bad idea. I think I've heard him talk about it before. Stealing your idea?
No, he hates it.
Really?
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. I kind of like it. We'll talk about Clemson coming up later on this afternoon. Yeah, 7 weeks from tomorrow, we'll have college football. For Hawaii, by the way, that's 9:30 a.m. Hawaiian time. Their fans will have to get up early for their first game. Super Dave's first prediction of the football season. UCLA wins week one. We'll catch up with the coach of the Charleston Battery next. It's the More Midday Show on ESPN Radio.